Cam and I are so pleased to have Podcorn sponsor today's episode of our True Crime Podcast. Explore sponsorship opportunities and start monetizing your podcast. Sign up today at podcorn.com/podcasters. That's podcorn, podcorn.com/podcasters.
Ladies and gentlemen, this podcast, truly one of the most unusual ever recorded, contains dribble, slang, and frank discussion of subject matter which under no circumstances should be heard by small children, persons with a heart condition, or anyone who is upset easily. If you are such a person, or if you are the parent of a very small child in the room, we urge you to switch off your streaming device now.
Hey, Jen.
Hey, Cam.
How are ya?
I'm great. I'm ready to start part two of the very special episode of our True Crime Podcast.
It's a very special episode, our True Crime
Episodes,
Podcast.
Episodes, I guess, correct?
Well, I guess it's one, but we're doing it in two parts just because.
Exactly.
So if you didn't listen to yesterday's, that's fine. But yesterday we featured, I guess, basically little mini episodes on the first five episodes of Netflix, I Am a Killer, which premieres Friday, January 31st. And as we talked yesterday, I'm nosy and I always go look up all these people anyway to find out what they do. And I was like, hey, that could be a show. We could help people because it kind of gets you a little bit prepared. Like I try not to give too much away of like where they are today or what they're doing. This is more like what they did to get where they are, right?
Right. And it kind of shows you maybe you want to watch episode five before you watched episode one.
That could be correct.
Yeah.
So you ready to do this? You ready to do this or what? You ready to do
it? Yes, I am.
Episode 6, Kavoina Flannoy.
Wow, that's a mouthful.
Just wait. I think that's how you say it. I'm not sure. And there's a couple hard names in here. So I apologize for that. And when you watch this, you can make fun of me all you want, seeing that I once again mispronounce something. But I think that's right, Kavoina Flannoy. On March 9th, 2010, shortly before 7:30 p.m., officers of the Riverside Department of Public Safety were dispatched to an apartment at 4911 Northwest Gateway Drive. Officers made contact with the resident of the apartment who said that his roommate was lying on the floor covered in blood. The man on the floor was Hassan Abbas, a 32-year-old Sudanese national. The officers and the responding fire personnel and EMS workers determined that the injured subject had suffered multiple gunshot wounds. Hassan was unconscious and unresponsive. However, a faint pulse was found by the EMS workers, and he was transported to North Kansas City Hospital, where he was later pronounced dead. The scene was secured by officers, detectives, and the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department Crime Scene Investigation Unit. As they're processing the apartment, they recover some spent .40 caliber shell casings and spent bullet rounds from the bedroom. They also found blood on the wall, floor, and bed of his apartment. As police continue to investigate, they determined that the victim's car, a 1995 dark blue Honda Accord with Missouri license plates, was also missing from the parking lot of the apartment complex, along with the keys to the vehicle, the victim's wallet, and his cell phone. Inside the victim's bedroom, they also find a pair of size 7 women's tennis shoes from inside the apartment. And obviously, he's a guy. He doesn't wear female tennis shoes. Whatever.
He could.
He could. You're right. I got it. A subsequent autopsy of the victim determined that he died as a result of multiple gunshot wounds to the torso. Police want to talk to Hassan's roommate. And he tells them, interestingly enough, that his roommate, Hassan, had recently met a woman by the name of Kavoina Flannoy, and in fact, he brought her to the apartment just the weekend before. It was determined that the victim had recently been introduced to Kavoina, who lived in the Kansas City, Kansas area, not the Kansas City, Missouri area. The woman was described as being in her early 20s, between 5 feet tall to 5 feet 2, and she was approximately 120 pounds, medium complexion, with short hair. Now that police have identified a person of interest, they set about looking for her. On March 11th, 2010, detectives locate the person that they're seeking in regards to this death, and they ask her to come with them. They had a few questions for her.
Just a few.
The woman volunteered to accompany detectives to the Riverside Department of Public Safety, in which she would be interviewed. The woman, strangely enough, she never even bothered to ask, hey, what's this about? She just said, yeah, sure, I'll come with you. Maybe that's a little red flag, I'm just saying. During the interview, Cavona acknowledged that she shot the victim several times with a .40 caliber handgun that she had purchased from a friend the previous Saturday. And that gun cost her $100. She had the handgun in a backpack, and she said that when Hassan brought her back to the apartment around 6:30 p.m. on March 9th, 2011, that her gun was in that backpack. She admitted that she took the victim's car when she ran from the apartment. Now, she later states that she changed the license plate on the victim's car to her old car's license plates that she had had on her car. She acknowledged that she also had the victim's wallet and attempted to buy gas with his credit card.
Well, of course she did. Yeah.
Right.
She's not going to spend her own money.
People are crazy. The Honda was subsequently located just exactly where the defendant said she had put it. Now, gets a little weirder here. I love stories like this in the sense that the weird things that people do. Okay, I'm just going to leave it at that. During a break in the interview, and you know, you're being taped. I hope all people know that, right? I mean, people know that, right? You're being taped. So just because an officer's not in the room with you, they're still watching you. They do that on purpose, right? They leave you in there. So during a break in the interview, she was left alone in the interview room, and they, you know, had the officer's pad of paper on the desk along with a writing utensil. And she started doodling, right? And she wrote on that pad along with her doodles, and this is a quote, "I'll push him down like I was going to fuck him. I got the gun and just pulled the trigger." Now, if you're in there, probably not a good idea to write that. Maybe it's a song. Maybe it's a song by Post Malone. I don't know. Probably you don't want to do that. I'm just saying. Cavona was charged in the Circuit Court of Platte County with murder in the second degree, armed criminal action, stealing a motor vehicle, and stealing a credit card. Now, she's going to plead guilty to these charges on December 9th, 2010. During that plea hearing, the state indicated it had some evidence, and if they're going to proceed to trial, they're going to bring out that evidence. Some of the things that they had, the prosecutor had noted that Cavona had scribbled that dear little note in the police interview room, right? And it also came out that she had, let's say, promised this nice guy, Hassan, a little sex, right? She promised him a little sex and tricked him basically to get to his apartment, right? So that's definitely premeditated, right? Prosecutors would seek life in prison for Cavona, arguing that during the sentencing hearing, she misled the victim, right? Which is what I just said about the sex. And that indicates that she had this all planned out. Maybe it would be him, maybe it would be somebody else, but she was going to kill somebody, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the criminal defense attorney for Cavona is going to cite what, Jen? What are they going to say about Cavona Flannoy? What have we learned in yesterday's show?
She had a bad childhood.
Correct.
She has mental problems.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Evidence was presented that Cavona had been raped and abused as a child, and this could have influenced the crime that she committed. Judge Owens Lee Hall Jr. sentenced Cavona Flannoy to 25 years in prison for the second-degree murder, 20 years in prison for armed criminal action, and 5 years in prison, each for tampering with a motor vehicle and stealing it. The judge ordered that the sentences run concurrently with one another. Cavona Flannoy must serve 85% of her sentence before she will be eligible for parole. That's it. Sad is what it is, Jen. Sad.
It is.
All right. Episode 7, Charles Armantrout. This fella is from St. Louis. This fella is a piece of work, let me tell you. You know, Jen, there are so many things that people have to adjust to when they're being released from prison, right? Where are they going to live? What kind of job are they going to have? Who's going to give them a fair shake in this world? All that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one of these that you need to secure before they even let you out is you have to have a place to live. And it has to be a sober place. It has to be a good place, right? They don't want you, oh, I'm going to live with my buddy Leroy. He's got a farm out there, right? They don't want that stuff. They want you to have a good solid foundation so that at least hopefully you'll be okay. So one of these things is exactly what happened to Charles Armantrout. One of the problems that Charles Armantrout had was just this. His family was tired of all his shenanigans and no way, Jose, are you coming back into our homes. Not one single person would take him in. Now, I mean, when you have the tendency to steal everything that you can get your hands on, probably makes it hard for your loved ones to, Trust you? Come on in. Yeah, come on in, Chuck. Right? So, Jen, this was exactly the case with Charles W. Armantrout. When he was released from prison in August of 1994, he had been serving time for several armed robberies. No one would take Charles in upon his release, and I stated earlier that you have to have a place to go. Now, no one would take him in except for that one person, and that one person was his dear grandmother, Mrs. Nodder. She was Charles's 81-year-old grandmother. Now, you think Charles would, you know, maybe have fixed his criminal ways in the pokey and appreciate that his sweet grandmother took him in, but alas, Jen, this is a true crime podcast, so
he's going to screw her over.
Yes, of course he is. Now, it started with Charles always asking her for money for a friend who needed help. He would always come up and say, you know, I have this friend, they're in big trouble, I just need some money, I need to help him out, and his sweet little grandma would write a check. Well, after a while, you know, this was happening again and again, and we know that money was not going to his sweet friend. It was right. going in his veins and up his nose.
And I'm pretty sure she probably knew that too, but didn't want to admit it.
Exactly. So Charles, you know, he's got a good thing going. He can't have his grandmother put the kibosh on this. I don't think so. So he decides, hey, I'm going to start forging her checks. And that's exactly what he started doing in December 1994. That didn't go on too long before employees at the bank where Mrs. Nodder had bet her checking account, and I'm sure had her checking account probably for years, because that's what older folks do.
You never leave.
The employees became suspicious about these checks, and one of the managers called her and told her about it. So she goes in and she looks at the account, and she is kind of shocked and very upset. There is a large amount of money missing from her account. She's a little freaked out. She doesn't know what to do, right? So on February 20th, 1994, Charles attempted to cash yet another forged check on his grandmother's account. But this time, bank employees call the police. They don't even bother calling the grandma. After the police arrive, they detain Charles, and they determine that he had stolen the check from his grandmother's checkbook. Now, being his grandmother, sweet, 81, she declines to press charges. The next day, Mrs. Nodder went to the bank, and the bank manager tried to persuade her to sign a forgery affidavit, which indicated that she would prosecute Charles in exchange for the bank reimbursing her missing funds. I'd be like, heck yeah, sign me up. But you know what happens.
I do know what happens.
Mrs. Nodder continued to be very upset about the missing funds, but she still refused to prosecute. And she explained to the bank manager that honestly, she was afraid of Charles and that she thought he would kill her if she did not continue to allow him to take that money from her account. Did you hear me? How terrible is that?
It's awful.
Like, is somebody stepping up and helping her? Of course they don't, or else we wouldn't be talking about it right now. On March 18th, 1995, at about 11 a.m. in the morning, Charles and a friend, Rick Lacey, go to Mrs. Nodder's house, and now they need money for drugs. Acting together, they beat this poor old woman to death with a souvenir baseball bat. She died from massive skull fractures caused by being struck over 12 times with the bat.
Now, the bat is the kind that you get from baseball games, correct?
Correct. They're smaller. They're not the great big ones. They're the smaller, you know, like 18 inches long or whatever. She also suffered a fracture of the lower jaw and 8 fractured ribs on the left side of her body, which appeared to have been caused by someone stomping on her. She did have defensive type wounds on her left hand and upper arm. Plus her heart. Seriously.
To have her own grandchild, right? Who she's taken care of, not just as an adult, but I'm sure as a child.
Horrible. What an asshole. Like, what? He's going to kill her for this money. In addition, both bones in her lower right leg were fractured, although this occurred after her death. You see, Jen, in order to dispose of the body, Charles tied his grandmother's 81-year-old grandmother's ankles together with a yellow cord and wrapped her body in a blanket and comforter, then secured her with a brown extension cord. He then stuffed her body into a trunk in her basement. And that's how she ended up with lower leg fractures.
Lord have mercy. I just can't fathom doing that to someone.
Anybody. But it's your grandma, too. Like, come on. At about 6 p.m. that day, Bridget Joseph, who was Charles's girlfriend, and Roger Brannon picked up Charles from his grandmother's house. As he came out of the house, he was carrying two large duffel bags of gifts for his girlfriend, Bridget. Charles told her that his grandmother had been doing some spring cleaning and wanted her to have some of the things that she no longer needed. Oh, and Charles also helped himself to $100 cash from his grandmother's dresser. And he used this, in addition to everything else, to go buy some cocaine.
Oh, well, good.
Could you imagine being his girlfriend and they bring you this gift and you're like, oh, Chuck, that's so sweet. And then you find out it's because he killed his grandmother. I'd kill him for that. Just saying.
I just looked up his picture. He's an old man now, and he's got dental
issues,
problems.
Well, lots of people in a pokey do.
Yeah, you'd think that would be.
Well, I know, right? They got a dentist. They get all that free.
I know.
But you don't have to go, I guess. Or drugs.
He's got a huge smile on his face, and I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 teeth.
Oh. He's got a couple to spare. That's good.
I guess.
After spending the night with Bridget at her grandfather's house, Charles told her he's going to go back to his grandma's house to see if he can get some more money. On his return to the home, he decided he needed to clean the walls and the ceiling of his grandmother's bedroom because, you know, that's where he killed her. And he also wanted to clean that souvenir bat and, you know, throw away anything that may have gotten blood on it.
Of course he did. That makes sense.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The next day, March 20th, 1995, Charles made several unsuccessful attempts to cash forged checks on his grandmother's account. At about 2:30 p.m., a bank employee called the police to report that Charles and a friend, Shirley Mendez, had just made a final attempt to cash a forged check through the bank's drive-thru window. The police arrest Miss Mendez, but Charles runs away. He flees, right? So they didn't get him. He flees. On the morning of March 21st, 1995, law enforcement officers find poor Mrs. Nodder's body in the trunk in her basement. In her bedroom, they find bloodstains, all kinds of, you know, red marks, and that was consistent with blood. And guess what? It sure was, because they tested it, and it had her DNA on it, or would have her DNA on it, rather. In Charles's bedroom, the officers find the souvenir baseball bat that had been used in the murder, and they noticed that blood and hair were embedded in cracks on the baseball bat. That DNA also was consistent with being Mrs. Nodder's. He didn't do too good of a job cleaning. At about 11:30 p.m., police officers were searching for Charles, and they arrive at Rick Lacey's house. As one of the officers approached the front door, Rick Lacey came out of the house and told the officers that Charles was inside. The officer then looked through the front window and sure enough saw Charles sitting there. He's in a chair. He jumps up and he runs to the back of the house. And then what's he do? Jumps out a window. I tell you. Several officers chase him, and of course they catch him in the backyard, where they arrest him and inform him of his Miranda rights. Charles was transported to the homicide investigation offices and was again informed of his rights and why he's there and all that good stuff. After indicating that he understood his rights and that he was aware of what was going on, because guess what, Jen?
What?
He was involved in some paralegal studies.
Oh, of course he was.
So Charles, he decides he's going to make an oral statement concerning the murder. Again, he's a good one, huh?
Oral statement with those teeth?
Yeah, verbal, no. I guess, would be the better statement.
Yeah.
Verbal. Now, he agreed to be videotaped, and I thought this was interesting, and I guess it's because of the time, but he did agree to be interviewed, and he was going to give his verbal statement concerning the murder. So the police take him to a nearby television studio.
Oh,
and
nice.
I thought that was kind of funny. In the videotaped statement, he related to officers that he and Rick Lacey came up with a plan on how to kill Mrs. Nodder Actually, they wanted to just maybe, you know, knock her unconscious and then steal her checkbook, right? And that he was the one that suggested they use, you ready? His what? Cardinal World Series souvenir bat as the weapon.
Aww.
Charles claimed that Lacey beat the victim with the bat while he put a chair and nightstand on her to hold her down. Now, I mentioned she's 81, right? She's 81.
Yeah. He didn't need much to hold her down.
Charles seemed to. Thank you. Charles then described how he and Shirley Mendez tried to cash one of her checks and how he returned to the crime scene later that next day to clean up the house and dispose of the body. He also described the items he stole from her and also talked about how he tried to go cash more checks, and that ended up being his downfall. Charles W. Armantrout, I bet you his middle name's William, that's why he goes with Billy. Charles W. Armantrout III was convicted by a jury in the St. Louis City Circuit Court of murder in the first degree, robbery in the first degree, and two counts of armed criminal action. The court sentenced Charles to death for the murder in the first degree and three consecutive life sentences for the other offenses.
Well, how come he's not dead yet?
I don't know.
Or do we know?
I don't know. You gotta watch the show and find out what's going on.
Cam and I, we both love having an independent podcast. What we don't love is getting overlooked for sponsorships because our podcast isn't quite a household name. At least not yet. But that's all about to change thanks to Podcorn. Podcorn is like a dating site for podcasters and sponsors. Big or small, Podcorn brings together sponsors and podcasters on an easy-to-use platform. You will work directly with sponsors you choose while picking the type of ad you want to do, and you even get to set your own rates. You will never give up the rights to your podcast, and Podcorn will help you all the way, including making sure you are compensated for the work you do for the brands. We've just started using Podcorn, and I really can't believe how simple the whole process is. I mean, we booked 3 ads our first try. So just don't sit around waiting for sponsorship opportunities to come to you. Make your sponsorship opportunities happen now. Go to our show notes, click on Podcorn's link, and start browsing sponsorship opportunities today.
Jen, episode 8, Brandon Hutchinson / Michael Salazar.
Salazar.
Two different names. Two different people, rather. But yeah. In the show, I believe they only focus on one, but the case involves two. On December 31st, 1995, Freddie Lopez and his wife Carrie were throwing a small New Year's Eve party in a garage that was just adjacent to their house. Ronald and Brian Yates arrive at the party shortly after midnight. They were looking for their brother, Tim Yates, who had apparently already left. Freddie Lopez invited them to stay for a few beers. You know, it's going to go bad. Nothing happens good after midnight, people.
Nothing at all.
During the party, several of the guests became intoxicated, because that's what people do during parties sometimes, and this included Hutchinson. Freddie Lopez and Ronald Yates shared a line of methamphetamine. Hutchinson caused a minor disturbance when he punched another guest, Jeremy Andrews, for no apparent reason. Andrews also observed Hutchinson making motions with his hands towards the Yates brothers. What those motions were, I'm guessing, you know, like punch him or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
At around 4 a.m., and let me just say right now, this is about the time I get up, not go to bed. So if we're still partying at 4 a.m., there's a problem, right? Somebody's got to go home. Just saying. At about 4 a.m., Freddie and Carrie Lopez went to the house to continue an argument that they had started in the garage about how much alcohol Carrie was drinking. Several of the partygoers ended up going home, leaving only Hutchinson, Michael Salazar, and Ronald and Brian Yates outside to party in the garage. About 20 minutes later, Hutchinson runs into the house and he pounded on the Lopez's bedroom door, saying that something bad had happened in the shop. Michael Salazar called for Freddie Lopez from the porch. You know that's a bad sign, seriously.
It's a very bad sign.
When Lopez comes out, Salazar was holding a .25 caliber revolver. He told Lopez that he had shot someone. Now, he shot someone. There's only 4 of them in the garage, and 2 of them are up there, so I'm just saying. Lopez enters the garage and saw both of the Yates brothers lying on the floor. Salazar told Lopez that one of the brothers had tried to stab him. Autopsies of the brothers showed that they had been shot at point-blank range with a .25 caliber gun. The bullet that hit Ronald Yates lodged in his spinal cord, paralyzing him from the waist down. Brian Yates sustained a relatively minor bullet wound to the chest and a more serious one to the stomach. Medical evidence later on established that both brothers were still alive. However, when Lopez found them on the garage floor, he testified that he saw Ronald Yates gasp.
Gasp?
Gasp for air.
Oh, okay.
Got you. Right, so gasping, so he's either alive or he is succumbing to his injuries, one or the other. Hutchinson insisted that nobody call the ambulance and that Ronald Yates was already dead. He then suggested that they remove the brothers from the garage in Lopez's white Honda Accord. Hutchinson and Salazar put Ronald Yates in the trunk first. Then Hutchinson put Brian Yates in the trunk on top of Ronald after dragging him by his shoulders, dropping him to the floor, and kicking him in the upper body. Meanwhile, Salazar went to the house to fetch a drug scale and a .22 caliber handgun, which he also put in the car. The three men took off in the car with Hutchinson driving. What is wrong with people? Swear to God. My God.
Unreal.
Right? After driving for a little bit, they pull over to the side of the road. Hutchinson and Salazar get out of the car, and they walk to the back. Lopez later testifies that Hutchinson climbed out of the car. He had the .22 caliber pistol with him, and he said, "We got to kill them. We got to kill them." Lopez heard several gunshots, and then Hutchinson and Salazar got back into the car. Lopez later testified that Hutchinson was still clutching the gun when he had returned to his seat. After pulling over and dumping the bodies on the side of the road, they went to a nearby creek bed where Hutchinson got out and actually buried the guns wrapped in his t-shirt. Again, probably not a smart idea, like you're leaving your t-shirt with the guns. They then drive to a friend's house, and Hutchinson begs for permission to take a shower because he had blood all over his hands. Yeah, that happens. The friend's girlfriend noticed Lopez's car. The three men returned to the Lopez house, and Carrie Lopez noticed a significant amount of blood on the car's back bumper. Hutchinson and Salazar left in the Yates brothers' car and drove to a friend's home, who then took them to the bus station. They bought two tickets to Yuma, Arizona. It was several days later, Hutchinson and Salazar were apprehended in California. A jury would convict Hutchinson of first-degree murder and recommend the death sentence. The trial court entered judgment for the same. So, Jen, that's that episode, and it's a doozy.
Let me just tell you.
So you have to watch the Netflix special, I Am a Killer, to see what happens. That's right,
girl. So that was episode eight?
Eight. Episode eight.
So now we're on episode nine.
Episode nine, Toby Lynn Williams. It's around 9:30 or 10 p.m. on the night of December 19th, 1984. Victoria Hinton and Wilma Franklin leave Hinton's home to go for a walk in their hometown of Greenwood, Louisiana. Now, that's located about 15 miles from the Texas border. Mm-hmm. The purpose of their walk was to get some cigarettes, but during their walk, they encountered a man by the name of Toby Lynn Williams. As the two women approached a bridge near her house, they came upon the man, and he's squatting down near the street holding a .357 Magnum pistol. Toby asked the two women, with whom he was acquainted, whether they wanted to make a couple of $1,000 by robbing a man at his house on Rice Road, which was nearby. Now, again, I am no genius, but I'm telling you, it's just not going to end
you
well.
You are no genius, but that's for sure.
You meet a guy in a ditch saying, hey, you want to do this? You'd think that the ladies would be like, yeah, you're cute. That's not going to happen.
No.
But then again, Jen, we do a podcast. So the three of them agree to carry out the robbery. But first, they decide they need to go to a friend's house, another friend. His name is JoJo Sims, and they're going to get some cigarettes from JoJo. Okay. I'm counting up all the names in these 10 episodes just to see how many names I did so that they can whatever. While at this friend's house, they smoke some marijuana and talk, and they finally went to the store for some beer and some cigarettes in the car of yet another friend who had driven by. and his name was Otis Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
After they make their purchases and they sit in the car and smoke some weed and, you know, listen to some music, Hinton and Franklin decide they're going to leave the car and start walking with Sims. Now, Sims soon left the three of them, the friend and the two girls, and walked back to his own house. The planned robbery was not discussed by the three of them in the presence of the other friends, right? So Williams, Franklin, and Hinton did not discuss that they were going to go rob somebody, right? So they meet up with them, having a good time, smoking, drinking. No robbery was spoke of, okay?
Mm-hmm.
After Sims left, the three of them, Hinton, Franklin, and Williams, walked to the house on Rice Road. Now, that's supposed to be Williams' house. It was approximately 11:30 p.m., when Williams knocks on the door while holding the pistol under his jacket. Johnny Moore comes around from a side entrance after turning on the outside lights. Johnny Moore asked, how could he help Williams? What are you guys doing? Williams then pulls a gun and told Moore to get inside the house and turn off the outside lights. Williams makes Moore go back into his bedroom where his wife, Deborah Gale Moore, was sleeping with their six-month-old baby. Williams demanded to know where Moore kept his money and his jewelry. He wanted it all. Now, Moore only had $11 in cash with him, so he gives it to him. Toby Williams then asked if Moore has any guns and proceeded to get his shotgun, his rifle, and steal that. Williams then asked Moore if he had any money in the bank and demanded his ATM card and his PIN to get access to the funds. Moore told him how to use it and to withdraw $110, which was in his savings. That's all he had in his savings.
Oh,
same, buddy. God. Same.
Yeah.
Williams took the keys to Moore's car and left to go get the funds from the account. Now, he left the two girls, Hinton and Franklin, there to guard Mr. Moore, Mrs. Moore, and the baby. Now, while Williams was gone, Hinton and Franklin collected items of anything that they thought would be of value, okay? And they're just like a bad TV show. They have a pillowcase and they're shoving stuff in the pillowcase, right?
Mm-hmm.
Williams was unable to get any money from that ATM machine. So Williams and the two women proceed to load up the goods from the house into their truck, right? So they steal a stereo, a console television, which cracked me up. I guess that's one of those great big ones, right? It's just
a big
TV.
And it's a piece of furniture. So
that's why I laughed.
They would steal it. Take at least two people to get
Well, I'm glad you said that because guess what? Williams made Moore help him load it. Made him helped him. You know, I'm stealing this, but you got to help me put it in my truck.
Yeah,
what?
I'm sure they weigh about 300 pounds.
So it was about this time that Johnny Moore realized that this person was Toby Lynn Williams, a former employee of his. Like Toby Lynn Williams worked for Mr. Moore, Johnny Moore, right?
Mm-hmm.
What? After he got back from trying to get steal the ATMs, and while they're loading all this up, Williams tells Hinton, the lady, that they're going to have to kill Johnny and Deborah because he's realizing that Moore realizes who he is, right? So they have names. This is, so now we're going to have to kill this guy, right? We can't leave a witness. Never leave a witness.
Mm-mm.
So after Williams, Hinton, and Franklin loaded up the truck with all their stuff, Williams tells the Moores to go get dressed because he wanted them to go with him to take care of some business. That's a bad sign, let me tell you.
Very bad sign.
It was then around 2:30 a.m. on the morning of December 20th, 1984, with Hinton and Franklin in the front seat and Hinton holding the .357 Magnum pistol on the Moores. He was in the back seat. Williams had him drive out to a relatively deserted road just across the border inside the Texas state line, some 15 miles from the Moore's house. Williams then told the Moores to get out of the car and give their six-month-old son to Franklin.
Oh.
When Mrs. Moore refused to give up her baby, which I don't blame her, I wouldn't
Many
either.
Many mothers would, yes.
Franklin slapped her to try to get her to give up the baby. Mrs. Moore finally relinquished the child to her husband, who handed the baby over to Franklin. Mm. Franklin and Hinton returned to the car with the baby, while Williams made Johnny and Deborah Gale Moore walk down the road from the car. Williams then told them to take off their clothes and make love to each other standing up. What? Yeah, you heard that right.
It's unreal.
When the couple was unable to do so, Williams ordered them to lie down on the street and have sex. Again, the Moores were not able to comply with this wish. Gee, I wonder why. While they knelt in the street facing each other, hugging and crying, wearing only their undergarments, Williams raised the shotgun and shot Deborah Gail Moore through the middle of her back. The bullet exited her body immediately below her bra and entered Johnny Moore's body. The Moores then fell to the ground immediately adjacent to one another. How sad is that? That's
horrible.
Williams proceeded to move Johnny Moore into a ditch on the side of the road, which was filled with weeds. He then tried to do the same with Deborah, but was unable to do so, apparently because her weight was too great.
Well,
you go, Deborah. Damn it. You had the last laugh.
Well, and you know, too, that a dead body.
Body is dead weight. Yeah.
It seems a lot heavier than.
She just had a baby 6 months ago, so she's probably still carrying baby weight, too.
So sorry, but damn it. They even fat shame women after they're dead. Come on.
Upon returning to the car, Williams said that they would have to shoot Moore again because he was not going to die from the wound which he had sustained, the one that went through his wife first. Hinton suggested that Moore would indeed die from the wound without shooting him again. Williams then got in the car, pulled up to where the bodies were, and shined the car headlights on each of them. The three then drove off with the baby in the car. Williams pulled over at a house on the side of the road and left the baby on the front porch of the house. Mm. Thank God. Thank God the baby's okay. But seriously, what is wrong with you people?
Exactly.
Williams, Hinton, and Franklin then returned to the neighborhood in which they and the Moores lived.
Right.
They abandoned the car in some woods that were located nearby, and they ran through the woods to go to Hinton's house. Now, they had originally planned to go back to Moore's house because, you know, they left that truck there. That's his. With all those goodies in it that they stole. But then they heard sirens and decided, maybe that's not a good idea. They did not go back to Moore's house, even though his truck is at Moore's house. Meanwhile, at the scene, Johnny Moore managed, bless his heart, Johnny Moore managed to get up out of the ditch and walk to a house to obtain help. Moore was able to tell the police the name of his assailant. While Johnny Moore was gone to get help, his wife, Deborah Gail Moore, died as a result of the gunshot wound that she had had. So, Jen, in the end, Toby Williams gets his punishment, but there's been some changes to the case, and I'm not going to go over that because you need to go watch Netflix
and find out what happened. Yep, starting Friday, I'll watch it.
Episode 10, Mark, Sam, Arthur. You ready for our final, Jen?
I am. It's the last one?
It is the last one.
Already? No,
I know, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, remember that movie To Die For with Nicole Kidman? Do you remember that movie?
Uh-huh.
And it was based on the Pamela Smart case, which Smart was the teacher who started having an affair with her student and then convinced the kid and his friends to kill her husband.
Supposedly. Uh-huh. No, but yeah, she still says she didn't.
Right. Okay. So this is a case very similar to that. Okay.
Okay.
Mark Arthur was just 17 years old in 1996 when he and his friend, 16-year-old Mason Hughes, stole a blue Cadillac at gunpoint from an elderly man outside a convenience store in Houston, Texas. The following day, with Mason driving behind the wheel and Arthur riding shotgun, the couple found Hesequiel Big Zeke Fonseca. He's going to go by Big Zeke, which really was his nickname. The two teenagers in the stolen car pull up alongside Fonseca's vehicle. Arthur would roll down the passenger side window, cock a 9mm at the man, and unload it into the driver. 13 bullets were fired. 7 entered Big Zeke's head, arms, and torso. You're probably wondering, how did a 17-year-old come in contact with this poor guy? But there's a little backstory to it, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So Fonseca's wife was named Carmen, and she's 41 years old. And it comes out that she had been having an affair with the young Mark Arthur.
Mm.
During this affair, she asked, I guess, her young 17-year-old boyfriend to kill her husband, and he obliged.
Oh,
right?
Uh-huh.
So during the trial, the jury would end up taking 22 hours to reach its decision on what should happen to the young Mark Arthur. After the verdict was read, Arthur's mother was crying in court, stating, "It's all my fault. It's all my fault." She was screaming, and then she said out loud she should have had an abortion.
Oh.
In court.
Ouch. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
At this time, the young man started crying too. The prosecutor would say, those aren't tears for him. Those aren't tears for the victim. He's upset that he got caught, right? He's upset that this is what happened to him.
Right. Of course he is.
But as we know, Jen, we go back to what happened with these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the jury would get to hear about Mark Arthur and his criminal history that dated back starting at age 12. He had a juvenile record for car theft and a conviction for carrying a weapon just at age 12, okay? Mark Arthur had also been tied to a string of crimes over a 23-day period the December prior to this event. And during that crime spree, there was accusations of burglary, attempted robbery, aggravated assault, car theft, among other things. So basically, they're laying out that he's just not a good kid, right?
Right.
His defense attorney, Kurt Wendt, asked the jury to spare Mark Arthur's life, telling them that the young man was influenced by a very evil woman. And he said that Carmen, the 41-year-old wife of the victim, had told Arthur that she was a battered woman. And after she had spun Mark Arthur in her little love nest trap, he believed it, right?
Right.
And he and his friend did go out and shoot and kill Big Zeke for her, basically.
Right.
It would come out 6 hours after the shooting, Mark Arthur returned to the car to steal Fonseca's wallet. In his confession, Mark Arthur said that when he approached the car the second time, he heard the victim making squeaky sounds, so he shot him several more times in the head. What is wrong with people? There's no question about who killed that poor guy on December 21st, 1996. It was Mark Sam Arthur, and everybody knew it. The police knew it. He knew it. He admitted it. But then this all goes into why. Why would he do this? So, of course, there's all these motives. The love affair gone wrong, the just being young and influenced, all that stuff. But bottom line, it's capital murder, right?
Oh, yeah.
He premeditated, went and killed him, and he's going to have to get punished for it.
I should hope so.
In the cases we've already talked about this, there was some debate that Mark Arthur had been physically abused by his stepfather as a child, and he had seen his sister beaten by her significant other. And he did apparently have some psychological hatred of men who beat on women and children, or that's what his defense attorney tried to play out.
Right.
Now, Mark Arthur would come forward and say that they did have an affair, but it was very brief and it was only a physical thing. And he would state that the motive was partly due to his hatred of violence against women, but it was mostly a kill or be killed thing. He said he feared that Big Zeke's revenge or vengeance would end up having him come back and beat him and kill him for having an affair with the wife.
Was it so kind of like self-defense? Is that what he's getting
at? That's what he would claim. But Jen, guess what? You're going to have to stay tuned to the Netflix series, I Am a Killer. Ooh. That's episode 10, and find out what happened.
You're going to leave me hanging, huh? Very interesting. So
there's some other things in there, and there's some the affair. There's a pregnancy mentioned in there, and
So there's like a bunch of drama going on there.
Mm-hmm, little life insurance policy maybe going on with Carmen taking that out, and therefore the having to get somebody young and naive to help her out.
Ah, yeah.
So, yeah. So there's a bunch of stuff, but you're going to have to stay tuned.
Going to have to watch it. Well, it's on my list now, that's for sure.
It's going to have to be, Jen. It's going to have to be.
Good job, Camille. That was a lot of work. You put a lot of work into that, too.
That's a lot of names, let me tell you.
It is a lot of names.
Most of these, I'll put these on our, I'll cite my sources. However, let me just say right now, I haven't seen the show, even though I tried, and I won't tell you about that. I tried to figure out a way to get it before it was released and watched, but that didn't happen. So basically what I did is I would look these people up and try to pull newspaper articles, court transcripts, whatever. So if I had a lot of detail, it was probably from a court transcript or a newspaper printing article, whatever.
Newspapers.
If there wasn't that much, I just tried to piece it together with newspaper only.
Yeah.
So it was a little choppy. Yeah. So that's
it. It's
so
funny when you work with
those. I did the legwork. You know what I mean?
It's funny when you deal with those newspapers that just a lot of the information is wrong. Nobody facts. It's odd.
You have different cities, different. Yeah. That's what I thought was funny too.
Anyway. So good job. Good job. Right. That was a lot of work. But hey, before we sign off right now, I just want to send our love, big hugs to David and Ernie, and I hope they know that we love them both.
Aww.
And I'm gonna cry here, but
don't cry. Oh my God, Jen. Jennifer loves animals more than people. If you haven't figured that out, but
Shenna will be missed.
She, she led a great life.
I know. She met well,
courtesy of him.
And
a good ending, a good later
life. She will be missed. Shenna will be missed and forever in our hearts. So Godspeed to her. And I hope Shenna goes off to run with Diesel up in dog heaven. Stay tuned to listen to a promo from our friends at an Apple for the Teacher podcast.
And don't forget our Fantabuloso bloopers after that. And let me tell you, there's a lot of them. So I do not even want a bad review. I don't want a bad review.
We know we screw up. We get it.
Names butchered. I get it. Trust me.
All righty then.
So remember, Jen, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love ya.
Today's episode was researched and written by me, Cam. For more information about this episode, as well as all the sources I used, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by hosts Jen and Cam. Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from October Pod VHS. Our True Crime Podcast is executive produced by Nico Vertese and Dick Bain. Make sure to like and subscribe to Our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcast. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter at Our True Crime Pod. You can email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. If you really like the show, make sure to check out our Patreon at Our True Crime Podcast. Our True Crime Podcast is an OTC production.
Hello, everyone. Let me tell you about the Apple for the Teacher podcast. I'm Anna Thomas, a teacher and your host. So you're probably thinking it's about reading, writing, and arithmetic, right? Well, think again. It's a fresh take on true crime, where you wouldn't expect to find true crime. In schools. Yes, schools. You will hear tragic stories about murder, abduction, school bus hijack, student disappearance, suicide, kidnap and ransom, a school camp tragedy, the list goes on. So if you're looking for something a little different in the true crime genre, then Apple for the Teacher is for you. So join me as I present the bad apples. But until then, remember to be a good apple.
Kansas City, Kansas or Kansas City, Missouri?
Missouri.
Ooh.
I still got a couple in here. Got a couple of this one and another one's from Missouri still. Boop, boop. Go Missouri. Go Chiefs. Whatever. You can cut that out, Nico. Cut that out, Nico. Cut that out.
All right, Nico. Hey, did we do the clap in the moment of silence?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. See, I'm not on my game.
You're not. You're a little behind, but that's okay. That's why I'm trying to get this. Get her done. Trying to make this is like a Band-Aid ripping off the wound. Here, we'll go. We'll start from here. Shake it off, man. Shake it off. Kavona Flannoy. Say that name with me, would you? Kavona Flannoy.
Kavona Flannoy.
See, it's hard, huh?
Kavona Flannoy. And that's if it's pronounced right. It could probably be like Candy Flonase, and we just don't.
It's true.
No,
it's
for true. True.
Yep.
My Kavona.
That's why I keep saying it, because I was like thinking Corona, and then Corona, the coronavirus, right? And that takes, this is the ADD people, and this guy wants to know why we're dinging mispronounced stuff. So I'm saying Kavona, but I'm really thinking Corona like the drink, and you're thinking my Sharona. But I was thinking Corona, which goes with coronavirus, which takes me to my friend Chris Roberts at work that made a big post on Facebook that if he died of the coronavirus, he wants to be put in a box with some salt and some lime, and he wants everybody to shake his thing. And that made me laugh. So that's where my mind all went in that one sentence. And people wonder how come we can't stay focused and do stuff. That's all I'm going to say about that. That's it.
That's it. Oh, sorry. That's it. Gotcha.
So well, anyway. That.
Bye, Kavona. Bye, Kavona. I was waiting.
I was like, that's it. She declines to press charges. There's my dog. I swear, she declined. Hold on, I gotta go let her out. I'll be right back. Hold on.
All right.
What?
Hey, Nico, how you doing?
What?
Are we driving you crazy yet? I'm sure we are. We're kind of off the game today, I do believe. So thank God you're the professional here. So what's going on? Doing anything fun today or tonight or tomorrow or anytime? Shh, Nico, don't tell Camille what we were talking about. Shh.
Shut up, I hate you. So my dog is so spoiled rotten with me. I always give her a little treat to go outside. Mm-hmm. Well, she barked. Obviously, she has to go outside. So I go open the door, and she just looks at me like, what?
No,
she
treat.
Will not. She will not go outside till I go get a treat.
Oh, good.
No, oh, God dang it. My chair was stuck. Okay. Hold on. Let me make sure we're still recording. That would be terrible. Okay. Let me get a drink. Hold on. In the videotape statement, he related that he and Rick Lacey discussed. I'm getting tired here. This is a lot of talking today. On December 31st, 1995, Freddie Lopez and his wife, Carrie, were throwing a small New Year's Eve party in the garage. Does that say garage? That didn't sound
it's
right.
It's the garage. Yeah.
I couldn't say it. Sorry. I told you this is a lot of talking for me. I'm on page.
Or garage.
That little shed.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Here we go. Ready? Sorry. Going to Winslow, Arizona. What a fine sight to see. I killed two boys, put them in the desert. And won't you take a look at me? Sorry.
That's good. That's thanks. Good.
Thanks. Oh, I'm sorry. Who's the other guy? JoJo. Is it JoJo? Sims. Is it Sims? No. Who's the other one? There's yet another one.
JoJo
Otis.
Sims is the
Otis.
One.
Otis. Okay. Otis. No, it's Toby, I guess. Heck if I know. Let's start that part over again. Arthur.
Ezekiel.
Right. Ezekiel. Okay, and then his last name is Fonseca. F-O-N.
Do we have the correct pronunciation of your name? Tom?
Ezekiel.
Ezekiel. Ezekiel. Not Ezekiel. Ezekiel.
I don't know, but he goes by Big Zeke, so I'm sure it's Spanish for...
Ezekiel. Yeah, that's what it is. The guy is Spanish. Yeah.
Well, gee, you think?
No, it says Spanish. Yeah.
I know.
So it's Ezekiel.
It's almost like I wrote the story, so I know he's Spanish. Or
I'm
Latino.
Just trying to
I got you.
Let you not be
hey,
the
Ray.
Your best friend's
how do you say his last name?
Dumb girl. How do you pronounce or what,
I know
how do you spell
mean.
It?
F-O-N-S-E-C-A. Fonseca?
F-O-N-S-E-C-A.